Okay. Hey, first, good evening. Thank you, everybody, for coming. And Amy will just speak to us in just a minute, but thank you very much to the Dorwiches for hosting this shiur. I wasn't sure whether they would want to or not. I said, we can have it in the shul, but I thought you might want to. And, of course, they were more than happy to host my father giving the shiur tonight. And we thank them for their hospitality and everything else that they contribute to the community. And I assume Amy will talk about the svarim that they're hopefully donating in memory of her father in just a minute. It's always, I don't think I've had the opportunity to introduce my father, Rabbi Joseph Ozarowski, ever. I don't think it's ever happened. So, first time. My father doesn't really need an introduction for me, obviously, but for you. So he's, in addition to being my father and one of my greatest role models in my life, as I wrote on the posting for the group, so he served in the Rabbanus in the United States for over 25 years, most of the time when I was growing up. Now he lives in Chicago, but still has a shul in Minneapolis. You can ask him afterwards how he does that. I'm still not sure, but he's not there every Shabbos. He also serves a number of capacities in the Chicago Jewish community as a chaplain in one of the local hospitals. He also works for the Jewish Healing Network, which is affiliated with the Jewish Family Services. You'll be hearing maybe some stories about some of his work with that tonight. And he's also one of the popular speakers on some of the topics we'll discuss tonight in the greater Chicago Jewish community, both in the Orthodox community and also in the non-Orthodox community. And it's really a great pleasure to have him here. He didn't come to give this year, obviously. He came to visit my kids. But once he was here anyway, he was more than happy to come and share some thoughts with us, which I think is a very nice conclusion for this series that we had over the last couple of weeks about Avelus, death and mourning. Our issue tonight is one that we did not really speak about during the rest of this shiur, and we spoke more about after death. I thought this was a good opportunity to speak a little bit about some of the end-of-life issues that come up when people are still alive, but unfortunately it's towards the end, and how do you work out some of the halachic and other types of issues. So Amy can fill in whatever I missed for a minute or two, and then...
On that note, it's hard to get started after those two glorious introductions. It reminds me of the old Rabbanish joke, an old ancient joke they tell the rabbi. What's the difference between an introduction and a hesped? An introduction, one person believes. Think about that for a minute. Nobody got that. You did get that. Okay. But really, I want to thank the Dorwiches for hosting this series, Evening Shabbos with Your Father, and for hosting me. And also a special thank you to this community, not just Yad Binyamin in general, but this particular sub community for hosting our children and grandchildren. All of you made Allah. I haven't yet. Give me time. I have to convince my wife first. But if all the grandkids are here, it's hard. It's really hard to stay away. But I know what has to be done because I follow it. The klita is very difficult. One of the things that softens the klita is when you have a support system here, and you all know that because you've all been through it in one form or another. So the fact that you've been the support system for our children and our grandchildren means a lot to us, and we are makir tov. We are grateful to you for that. There are a number of tanchumin to offer tonight. There's a lot of loss here. We mentioned Amy's father. There are other people I've met here. And, it's interesting. In the literature on the subject of bereavement, I can't pinpoint this. I put together the source for this just a couple hours ago, although a lot of this is very much in my head, but I can't pinpoint the source for this. In the bereavement literature, they always tell you that when you're suffering, the first loss you ever suffer in your life colors every other loss you always had after. You're always going back to that first life, the first loss, rather. And I want to be makdish tonight's shiur to the memory of my chavruta, who's your artist tonight, by the way. I'll tell you a minute about him. My chavruta and my best friend, all the shalom, was Rabbi Stanley Greenberg. He was an interesting guy, actually. Grew up as secular as they go in the Upper East Side of New York. Classical form, went to an ethical culture high school, that's as secular as it gets, went to the University of Chicago, became dati at the University of Chicago, and then started yeshiva at the Skokie Yeshiva after college, which is when I met him. And we were in smicha together, we were incredibly close, we knew each other better than two people usually know each other. Stood up at each other's weddings, I had to do with his marriage, I brought them together, he actually married a very dear friend of mine from St. Louis, and we were very close, and he was unfortunately killed in a car crash on Yud Tet Menachem Av in 1979. and one of the first funerals I ever did as a young, freshly minted green rug out of yeshiva was for my best friend. It was one of the hardest things I ever did in my life. I remember the physical feelings I felt. When you lose somebody, a piece of your gut is grabbed out of you. I remember the physical feelings, and I think of them when I do my counseling. I often reflect on that when I'm trying to offer support. So this is Harav Shlomo ben David Hirsch. Stanley, this is for you. I know you'd appreciate hearing this all. He got a great sense of humor, too, and he would have appreciated all this. Okay. We're going to go through the sources on the sheet. It's going to be halacha, agadata, but a lot of personal reflection and experience as well, because that's what I do. I don't claim to be the world's greatest Talmud Chacham. I sit and learn. I have the poskim that I turn to. The difference that I bring to the work that I do is that I work in a hospital. Most poskim don't work in a hospital. To be able to combine those two actually is a very special art, which I constantly work at. The poskim I took, you're going to meet tonight. I'll be bringing them into the shiur as well, and some of the things I learned from them over the years, as well as some of the original thinking that I've done on some of these topics. I'm going to try to cover introduction with Bikur Cholim, advanced directives, moods at the end of life, including dementia and non-dementia confusion. We're going to deal with hospice and feeding tube issues and vidui. And we'll see how much time we have. There's going to be plenty of time for questions. I want to have questions, so your questions are welcome. And you may have situations you want to bring up, and if I can offer some help or support, we'll be glad to do that.
Do you throw DNRs in there also?
Absolutely. That is one of the prime things I'm going to talk about, actually. DNRs are changing as we speak. Illinois just changed theirs, actually, moving from a DNR to what's called a POLST, and I'll tell you what that means when we get to it in the middle of this year. So I'm glad you mentioned that. It's very much in there, okay? In fact, I should probably just write this down just to make sure I get it.
What is a DNR?
Do not resuscitate order.
Oh, okay.
Okay, it's a doctor's order given by the family. The family makes the decision, the doctor has to write it in, and it's changing more to be with doctor's support. But it used to be the patient's decision. Now it comes up with the doctor's decision, but it's still the patient's decision if they don't want to be resuscitated, or they do want to be resuscitated. But DNRs do not resuscitate. We'll talk about what that means clinically and what the halakhic implications of that are as well. Let's look at the first two sources. These are two of the classical sources that I have gleaned and use when I teach Bikur Cholim. We're not going to do them in depth. We're going to just refer to them a little bit. We're in the second one because it's a fun one to learn. The first one is the Gemara in Sota Daf Yud Aleph, which in my opinion is the foundational Maimar Chazal, the foundational text dealing with not just Bikur Cholim, but all of Gemilut Chasadim. Very, very quickly, Chazal asked the question, Acharei Hashem Elokechem Teilechu, you're supposed to walk after the Lord your God. How can you follow God? God in Dvarim is also Esh Ochla. What's going on here? I could spend an hour just talking about this one passage, but we're not going to have that here tonight. Another time when I come back here, maybe. So the answer is, what does it mean to follow, walk after God? Eloh Achar Midotav Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the third line. It means to walk in God's ways. That's where I got the title for my book, and now you know. Okay? It means to walk in God's ways, God's Midotav, God's attributes. And Chazal could have stopped there, but they didn't. They gave four examples. Malbish Arumim, just as God clothed the naked, you're supposed to do that too. You can see the example inside. Just as God visited the sick, by Avram Avinu, so you too should do that as well. God comforts the bereaved, Nicham Avelim, you too should do that as well. And God is Kover Metim, God buries the dead, God officiates at Moshe Rabbeinu's funeral, you're supposed to do that as well. So the point of Bikur Cholim and Nichum Avelim and all of the actions that are concomitant with those is not just nice things to do. They are nice things to do. But what Chazal are saying here is that we're becoming godlike when we reach out to people at these moments. And the question, which if I had an hour, we would discuss this in detail, but I'm just going to give you the answer. The question is, why did Chazal take examples? And why dafka these examples? In other words, there are 613 mitzvot, and well, if you want to be like God, you should eat kosher meat, or fast on Yom Kippur, or offer korbanot, or etc., etc., etc. Instead, Chazal took these examples because these are the most human of examples, dealing with people at their most vulnerable moments, poverty, illness, bereavement, and when they're dead. So to be like God, if you want to be like a Kadosh Baruch Hu, you have to be as human as possible. And that's why my theory is that God is also a humanist, because God wants us to be humanist towards each other. That's what's required here. And keeping in mind just two points that come with this, notice that, of course, in the Western world, in the Christian world especially, we have a name for this kind of what we call pastoral care. It's the role of the pastor in Christian theology to do these things. It's documented. Read the second half of chapter one of my book where I talk about it. I do it too. I mean, part of my work is also pastoral counseling and pastoral care. But if you follow the Gemara here very, very clearly, there's no role for a rabbi in here. It doesn't say that the Rab or the Chacham or the Tzadik or the anybody else, not that I'm any one of those, but that it doesn't say that these people have to do this. It is no more my mitzvah to go to the hospital and visit the sick than it is yours. That doesn't mean Rabbanim shouldn't have special skills. I think they should. It's another topic for another time. But I want to put it on the table that I really strongly believe Rabbanim need special kinds of training. They should really take inter-chaplaincy training in order to do their regular job as Rabbanim. I think that's really, really helpful. I'm an advocate for that. I think it's just good. So Rabbanim should be specialists in these things. But everybody should do these mitzvot. It's everybody's mitzvah. And one other point before we move on, and that is that when you read this Gemara carefully, it sounds like an Agadata. Surprise, it's not. Look at look in the Rambam. I'll tell you where it is. It's in Hilchot Aveil Perek Yudalid, where he rewords this and brings this down. Look in the Shulchan Aruch in Yoredeya. It's in Shin Lamed Tet, I believe. It's in there. Ravelli can correct me if I'm wrong. Look at the Perish of Gra in there. The Gra clearly states that this Gemara is the source for the halacha. So it's not just agarata, it's halacha. These are mandated things that every Jew is supposed to do. We're all supposed to do this stuff. So that's the basis for this. One more point on Bikur Cholim before we get into the meat and potatoes that we're going to do tonight. This is one of my favorite midrashim. It's a midrash rabbah. Dama Rav Huna said, Kol mi shemvakar tacholeh, pochtin lo echad mishishim becholio, takes away a 60th of their illness. Utvei lo Rav Huna, so they asked Rav Huna, in Cain, this is a great one, I love the way it's worded, in Cain, if that's the case, yalu shishim v'yered imahem lashuk, let 60 people come and we'll go to the kanyon together, we'll go to the mall together, you know? 1/60th for one visitor, get 60 and we'll all go shopping together, right? Amar Lahem Shishim, he said 60, that's not really what it means. It only works as long as the visitor loves the patient as they love themselves. We would call this in clinical terms an empathic connection, which is done through careful listening. And if you have reflective listening skills, that's really helpful. When we do Bikur Cholim training, even for lay people, that's part of what we do at the Healing Network, we train reflective listening skills. How to listen, how to mirror what you've heard, how to feedback what you've heard, how to listen for feeling words. So when you go to visit someone who's sick, always remember it's not about you, it's about them. The afal pi chein, but even if you don't, marvichin lo, it still helps. Even if you blow it somehow, it's still a good thing. It's a helpful thing. You have a question? Okay. The one little point on the 1 in 60 thing. I mean, 60, if you've learned some of these things, 60 is what we call a rabbinic fraction. Where else do we find 1 in 60? Somebody know. Batel b'shishim. Right, okay. Where else do we find 60? Anybody else know? Chazal say that sleep is a 60th of death.
Shabbos is a
60th of... Shabbos 60th of Olam Haba. Okay, so what's a 60th? It's in computeries, we have some tech people here, it's a byte. It's a minimum amount. It's a rabbinic fraction. It's not really important whether when you go to visit someone, it really takes away 60th. The exact amount is not really important. What is important is, number one, anybody who does Bikur Cholim a lot, whether as a lay person or, like me, as a professional, knows from anecdotal experience that visits really help. A good visit really helps them. Not just by making them feel better, but it often helps them physiologically. And that's probably because when you set a person's mind at ease by letting them know you've been heard, it helps the body heal itself. And what's interesting now is that there's all sorts of clinical studies and clinical data out there to suggest that it really, really works. There's a whole school now of academic studies. Herbert Benson at Harvard Medical School, Pargament at the Bowling Green, Stanford, and the Duke University. There are places that do these studies. Larry Dossey's book, Healing Words, which all demonstrate that this actually works. Not a guarantee. Doesn't mean this one they're going to get better. Doesn't mean that. But the one classical study that I remember is the Stanford study from the late 90s of about 400 and something heart patients. And one of the best barometers of quicker healing was the extent that they were connected to a community, and that the community cared about them. And that's Bikur Cholim. Being part of a religious social community, which is what we're all about, can actually help the healing process. Guarantee? No. We don't know what a Kaddish Baruch Hu has in store for us. But as data goes, this is data. There are numerous studies that suggest it actually does work. It actually can help. The chances are better that they will get better. Okay? All right. Now, that's in more cases where people get better. What happens when people don't get better? And the fact is, there's going to come a point in people's lives where they don't get better. Rav Gedalia Schwartz Shlita, who is the Rosh Beit Din of the Rabbinical Council of America and of the Chicago Rabbinical Council, and my personal posek, one of the people I turn to for intuition and guidance in Hora, I quote him as saying, and he said this to me, he says, every human being is created with an expiration date. Okay? We're all going to die. And being able to know that helps you live life to its fullest. This is me. This is my aura now. That knowing this, knowing that we're all mortal, that Hashem created us with mortality, helps us to remember to put things in perspective, that we're going to live life better. So what happens when you know things aren't going to get better? That's the rest of this year. Okay? Let's talk about advanced directives and we'll get to the DNR orders from there. Let's take a look at Bereishit, okay? The first advanced directive in history is in the Chumash. I should probably go back. What's an advanced directive? Advanced directive, and I'm using the American terminology, I'm not familiar enough. Thank you very, very much. Baruch atah enough. I'm sure call me a Baruch. So, I'm giving. Put it back in. Thank you. So I'm using American terminology. I'm not as familiar with how it works in other countries. And if you want to enlighten me, that would be great. Although on the way here, it was by Shert actually. My flight from Chicago to Toronto on the way to Israel was an hour and a half late at O'Hare. I almost missed my Air Canada flight from Toronto to Israel. But what was good, there was a whole group of Torontonians, Canadians, from people who were at a Chicago wedding. We knew the people, actually, who were stuck with me on the same flight. I got to talk to them. One of them is actually a litigator on medical issues who told me about what's going on in Canada on these things. And I'll tell you what he told me. I can bring an update on that. But in the U.S. right now, it's not required to have an advanced directive. Advanced directive is basically what your wishes are. And there are two points to it. One is the power of attorney. Who you want to make decisions for you in medical care, in health care, if you cannot make those decisions yourself. So somebody who knows you, who trusts and trusts you, who will make your decisions, a family member or a close friend, whatever. Yes?
So I might be able to interject a little bit. In Israel, it's a lot more complicated. From what I understand, there is no such thing as a power of attorney when the person is unable to make the decision himself. I know that doesn't sound like it makes sense, but that's you give a power of attorney to your attorney to take care of your real estate deal if you're incapacitated. If you're incapacitated, the power of attorney doesn't hit. So it's a very difficult issue in Israel that has not been resolved.
Okay. Thank you for mentioning that. That's helpful. So what I'm going to say is going to help you if you have family in the U.S., not in Israel. It won't be helpful to you. In America, there are two powers of attorney right now. The one I'm going to talk about is the health care. There is also a financial power of attorney. It's a separate document, and the two aren't always identical at all, actually. In fact, in hospitals, they don't deal with financial stuff. They don't touch it. But if you go to an American hospital, they'll ask you if you have a health care directive. So part one is the power of attorney. It's a simple thing. You designate so-and-so to make your decisions if you are incapacitated. That's the whole thing. The second half is more difficult, both for the person to wrap their head around it and also in terms of the halachic issues that are around it. And that's the advanced directive. If you are in a state where medical care is not going to be meaningfully helpful to you, do you want aggressive care, only comfort care, something in between, special wishes, etc., etc.? So most healthcare powers of attorney are actually along those lines with that second part. Every state's a little bit different, but essentially the second part asks you, what do you want if you know you can't tell us what you want and you know things are very, very dire for you? How aggressive do you want us to be? It's hard to make that decision. because what you might think right now might not be what you're going to think in 119 years, you see. So it makes it kind of tough. In addition, halachically, there are all sorts of issues going about. So there are a couple of what are called halachic advanced directives floating out there in the States. Two main ones that are out there. One is put out by the RCA, the Rabbinical Council of America. The other is put out by the Aguda. They're worded and styled differently, but the essence is the same. What they will tell you is, basically, I want my medical decisions made according to halacha, and this is the halachic authority to whom I want you to turn if I can't tell you who. So it's the RCA, the CRC, the VAD of somebody, Rav Schechter, Rav Schwartz, Rav Tendler, whichever Guttel or Posek or Shulrav or whoever, you know, you choose, you can put anybody you want on there. Okay? We generally don't recommend, by the way, having people put their Rabbonim as the powers of attorney, though. That would make it very hard on the rabbi. And in fact, we recommend that the more important part of this is not what you sign or what you check off in terms of what care you want, it's having the conversation with your family. Talk. Listen. Think about what they want. Now, here's the first example of the first advanced directive in the Chumash. Let's read this together. Vayikru yimei Yisrael lamut, and Israel's days of death came. Vayikra livnov Yosef vayomer lo, so he calls son Yosef, the prime minister, and he says to him, Imna matzati chen dei nechas dina yadcha tachit yirechi, please, if it meets favor in your eyes, put your hand on my thigh. Vayasita evadi chesed v'yamet, do me this act of truth and kindness, I'll not take bereni v'mitzrayim, don't bury me in Egypt, bury me in the homeland, here, Israel. And I want to lie with my ancestors and be born out of Egypt and be buried in their burying place. Okay? Vayomer, and Yosef says, sure. Anochi esekid varech. I'll do as you wish, Father. Yes, of course. Not good enough for Yaakov. Yaakov says, Vayomer, he says, Yishavali, swear it to me. Get it notarized. Get it stempled. Get everything you need for it. I need it official. Vayishavalo, he swore to him, Vayishtachu Yisrael Erosh Mita, and you know how that's translated. Okay? So this is the first advanced directive in history. Yaakov tells his wishes to his son, his power of attorney, his closest relative who's in charge of things in Egypt, and Yosef says he's going to carry it out, and the fact is he did carry it out. It wasn't a medical care advanced directive, but it was clearly his wishes, it was clearly that. So we tell people advanced directives are really important. Sometimes it's really easy. Personal story. My experience with my father, Oliver Sholem, who's been gone from this world about 3 years. He had a really... I'm going to use him. I have to tell you, my father was a Holocaust survivor, died at the age of 96, never thought he would live to see great-grandchildren, but he did. He met Menachem. He met a couple of Menachem siblings. He had that squib. And he taught me, in other words, he was a very simple yid, but an incredibly learned guy with great courage who taught me how to face death, even though he had issues, and I'll tell you about them as well. But when we, about, 3 years ago, this would be 5 years ago, and Rav Eli remembers this very vividly, we thought we were going to lose him. We had this wonderful Pesach planned with my parents in St. Louis, Missouri. You remember the trip to St. Louis? Remember that? Okay, we had everybody's coming in for it, Rav Eli and his family, my other son, Rav Sholem, and his family, and my kids from New York, Rafi, our youngest, and Chani, my daughter, and her family. They're all going to come in and spend, but it didn't work out. My father had a nosebleed, which turned into an infection, which turned to C. diff. He went to the hospital, then he went into rehab. We thought he was going to get better. Turned out he was getting worse, and worse, and worse, and the tickets had already been bought. We spent that Pesach together. The Siddurim were in a Marriott, right near the Jewish Home for the Aged in St. Louis, out in the middle of nowhere. No Eruv, and no... There was a shul. The home had a shul. And a minyan and a rav who invited us to be a part of their siddurim and let me take it over just so we wouldn't feel ill at ease. Then on the second day of the Chag, it's 2 days, if you remember, back in... You remember that, don't you? Right? On the second day, in the middle of davening, my father was taken by emergency to the hospital again. And that was our first day of Pesach. You weren't there the first days, the rest of the family was. Rav Eli came in for the second days. We brought my dad home for the last days. He was thin, he couldn't eat, and we thought this was it. And I will never forget this, and you took wonderful care of him, I gotta tell you. You remember that, don't you? When you went to Elder's ID in St. Louis, when you were at home? So I asked Dad, what are your wishes? What do you want? what do you want here? And he says, Yasullah, he says, I'll tell you what I want. I want to die in my own bed. I don't want to suffer. I want my family with me. I want the dignity and respect the Nazis denied me. But another year or two of life would be nice. Okay, Tata, that's what we'll give you. I said, Dad, did you ever hear about hospice? He says, yeah, it helps people die in peace. I said, wow. He was 94 at the time, 94-year-old, Polish, Yiddish-speaking, un-Americanized, Holocaust survivor father got hospice. I said, okay, Dad, that's what we're going to do. And as the story happened, we got him onto a palliative care program. Palliative care is basically pain management. It's included in hospice, but it's not the same as hospice. Hospice includes palliative care. Palliative care is not the same as hospice, though. Hospice is end of life. Palliative care may or may not be end of life. We decided he needed some more support at this point, and because he looked like he was dying, but we weren't sure, we wanted him to have the speech therapy and the OT and the PT, and that's what we did. We got him on supportive care from Barnes Jewish in St. Louis, and surprise, he got better. He actually lived another 2 years. He got the 2 years he asked for, almost to the week, almost to the day, actually. He died. This is all Pesach. He died right before Pesach, 2 years later. So that's an illustration.
He teaches us he shouldn't be afraid to ask.
What's that? What, I'm sorry?
You shouldn't be afraid to ask the thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So let's talk about some of the issues that come up. I want to say a word about ethical wills. Okay, I didn't bring any samples. Again, I wasn't able to prepare everything before I came here, but there are examples of ethical wills. What's an ethical will? It's not a will as far as what to do with the, you know, the condo in the Hamptons, and what to do with the yacht, and what to do with the condo in Yerushalayim. It's what you want for your children and grandchildren. What lessons have you learned from life? What do you want to convey to them, that how they should live, to keep mitzvot, to be a mensch, to treat people well, etc., etc. The best source I know, there's a book called Jewish Ethical Wills by Jack Reimer and Nathaniel Stamfer. It's really a whole series of ethical wills over several thousand years, going back to the Rishonim and earlier. There are things from the Holocaust in there. It's really a wonderful piece of work. It's a great thing. So people should write ethical wills. Besides your medical wishes, what are your wishes for your children and grandchildren? Okay. Let's talk a little bit about dementia, and then I'll talk about the non-dementia cases, okay? Let's learn another Gemara. Let's learn a Gemara that's maybe about dementia, although I'm going to interpret it and then give you some other things. This is number 4. This is a Gemara in Nedarim. This Gemara in Nedarim is part of a long sugya dealing with Bikur Cholim. The first half of my book is actually all about that long sugya. Kol Mishkavo Hafach B'Cholyo. This is a pasuk from Tehillim Mem Aleph, which in many ways is the kapitel Tehillim for Bikur Cholim. I don't have time to explain why that is, but it is, trust me. Omar Rabbi Yosef says, it means Kol Mishkavo, may you turn all of his lying down in his sickness. It's a prayer to Hashem, asking Hashem to turn sickness around. Omar Rabbi Yosef said, Lomar, this means to say, Dimishkach Li Mudo, that someone who has to be turned around, it means that when they get sick, they forget their learning. This happens frequently. A serious illness often affects people with their memory. And certainly dementia affects people with their memory as well. Now, Rav Yosef taught this. Rav Yosef Chalash. Now, the Gemara continues. Rav Yosef, the Rebbe here himself, got sick. Yakar Leili Mudei, and his learning was removed. He forgot. He lost some of his memory and some of his learning. Ahadre Abaye Kamei, and then Abaye, his Talmud, then return his learning to him. What that means, I'll give you an idea what that could mean in a moment. But here it shows you an idea of Chazal understood. This is why people often say, it's often said, Amar Rav Yosef, Rav Yosef said, Lo Shmieli Hada Shmaita, that Rav Yosef, I never heard that teaching, I never heard that learning. Amar Lai Abaye, and Abaye has said to him, At Amrita Nihalan, you're the one who taught it to us, you told us this. Umeha Matnita Amrita Nihalan, and this is where you got it from, this is your source, this is your mission you got it from. So here's a case where a Talmud very gently helped his Rebbe remember things that he had forgotten. Okay? So someone who has early memory loss, it's not advanced dementia, it's various forms of early memory loss, it's a nice thing if you can find a dignified way to help them remember what they have forgotten. This partly helps people who are aware and are cognitively operating to remain rooted in their lives by bringing them to their lives, you know, in small, very gentle ways. So in an early stage, this can be very, very helpful. When you get further into dementia, though, the Gemara is not helpful at all. There are other things you can do. In other words, the first thing that goes with most forms of dementia, there are several different forms. The most common one is Alzheimer's and related ones. There's also a vascular dementia. There are other forms as well. I think 70 or 75% of dementia is Alzheimer's, which we don't know exactly what it does, but from neurological scans, it seems that Alzheimer's clogs up the brain, the neurons in the brain, and they basically degrade, so you forget large chunks of things. The first thing to go is short-term memory. You may remember things from a long time ago, but you don't remember yesterday or even 15 minutes ago. In those kinds of cases, don't try to root them because it's not going to help and it makes things worse. A common Shiloh I often get, and it's sometimes it's framed as a Shiloh and sometimes it's a general, you know, advice kind of thing, not always as halacha, because I have these questions, a lot of my non-Orthodox clients often ask me this. Someone has dementia, okay, and their spouse dies. Do you tell them about the loss? Do you take them to the funeral? Depending on the dementia, but if their short-term memory is shot, we tell them, don't tell them. It's not going to help, because 15 minutes later, they're not going to be able to remember it, and they will not be able to process the grief, and they're going to be grieving all over again, every 15 minutes. That's really unhealthy. That's really, really very, very bad for them. So what do you tell them? Something like, oh, they went out. They went away. They'll be coming back. And that usually satisfies them. Okay? A more advanced stage of dementia is where they can't even operate well, before I get to that, let me tell you another story. And professionally, what I try to do with dementia patients is try to, if they're on another planet, I try to go on their planet. Here's another one of my favorite stories. I have two good dementia stories. How much time do we have? Okay.
25 minutes.
Okay, good. I had a patient, hospice patient, who was in a nursing home. She thought I was the rabbi of a huge shul right in the neighborhood. And when she gets out of this hospital, as she called it, she's going to come and run my sisterhood and cook Shabbos meals and work my office and help me out. I kept trying to tell her I don't have a large shul. I don't really have a shul at all. I do this kind of work with them. Didn't get through. After a while, I thought, you know, Joe, Rabbi Joe, you're being stupid. You're being an idiot here. Don't do this. Just go wherever she goes. Whatever planet she's on, go to her planet. It was a great planet. This woman was wonderful. She was happy and cheerful. I said, if I got dementia, I want to be on her planet. So I said, sure, I'd love to come have you help my sister. I'd love to have you work in the shul kitchen, the shul office. It'll be great when you get out of here. And she was very happy. She was very, very happy. So that's one story. The next story is in the case where the cognitive functions just are totally breaking down. They can't even talk. Whatever they talk is gibberish. It makes no sense. Or it's half sentences. It's not linear. It doesn't come together. That's a very advanced form of dementia. What do you do in a case like that? So you can't even have an extraplanetary conversation with them. You can't have a conversation, really. But there are ways you can reach people like that. Sensory things. Music. Touch. These respond, there's a different part of the brain that responds to music and sensory perceptions. That's not the same part of the brain as the cognitive skills, and it's often not mucked up by dementia. Here's another one of my favorite stories, okay? Had a hospice patient, we'll call her Lucy. In her life, she was a really distinguished person. She was a chemist and a high school teacher as well. No children. Her husband was dead, and she had nobody to look after. She was looked after by a guardian. A guardian. There are people who look after people for a fee. So her estate had a guardian that looked over her. And by the time she came on our hospice service, the ones that we work with at the Jewish Healing Network, she couldn't really communicate anymore. It was all gibberish. I mean, we knew she was saying something, but you couldn't understand her. And they say it had been months since she had said anything meaningful. This really happened. It's a dramatic story, but it's one of my favorites. So I visited her a couple times. They weren't particularly meaningful visits, but, you know, I figure something maybe got through, you know, who I was, what I was. one time, the only chance I had to visit her was a Friday afternoon. So I went Friday afternoon, it was in June, a few years ago, in June. And I said to her, Lucy, it's Rabbi Ozarowski, Rabbi Joe, that's what people call me. It's Friday afternoon, tonight is Shabbos, and I want to sing you a song from Friday afternoon when the angels come and greet us at the Shabbos table, and I'm going to sing you that song right now. And I started singing. Shalom Aleichem, Malachei HaShareis. And then she joined in. Malachei Elyon. Correctly and sweetly and on key with the correct words and sang the whole thing. And then she said, sing it again. So I sang it again. And again, this went on for about 25 minutes. I was in shock. I just couldn't believe this. She was actually singing this with me, with a nice voice and with the right words. And then she started talking. She told me how when she was a little girl, this is what her father sang at the Shabbos table, and how she remembers it. Wow. This woman hadn't said anything that was meaningful in a couple of months. Somehow, and I don't claim to have any special skills here. There was no magic I brought into the room here. But the music touched a part of her brain, and she was able to respond to that. That happens in my work and in the work of people who do the stuff that I do frequently. So if you have... I'm sorry?
My wife's grandmother also reached a point that the music, if she responded and remembered the music.
Thank you for sharing that, Rav Orlean. It's true. It really works. Touch, smell, other types of stimulation, music, sing. They don't refine anything else to sing to them. They may not, even if they don't sing along, they will often tap along with the correct beat. They will, the facial expression, they will respond to that. So that's dementia. Okay? All right, what about somebody who doesn't have dementia? So one of the important things to do with somebody who is cognitively aware of things as they are declining, especially if they are aware of their decline, is what we call life review. We would call it HESPED, but not HESPED after death. HESPED means telling the story. If you look at the linguistic derivatives of HESPED, it's related to the words to sweep up and gather together, a safe, there are some connections there. Help them gather their memories together. Let them talk, you listen, ask them about their lives. I did this with my father quite a bit by the way, and he told me some amazing things about things that, I mean, he told me stories about the Holocaust, about his childhood, so I knew a lot of the classic Ozarowski family stories, but he shared some things that he never shared with me before. He told me about his experiences in the Polish Army, which I'd never heard. I knew he was in the Polish Army in the mid-30s, but I never heard the details. He told me details. Spent time with you a little bit, didn't he? Told you some stories. So that was that is really, really important. Now, towards the end of life, even people who are cognitively aware, they get a little bit confused. In my father's case, he was hit with something called late-onset PTSD. PTSD is post-traumatic stress disorder. Holocaust survivor, right? You know, in fact, the classic studies of PTSD were based on Holocaust survivors. Now they have, you know, prisoners of war and people coming back from Afghanistan, Iraq, and the American Army, so it's all out there. But they, with Holocaust survivors, a lot of this stuff hits them at late ages. It comes back. With my father, it hit him as well. He had some paranoia towards the end of his life. I won't give you all the clinical details, but, you know, it was hard on my mother and on me in terms of caring my sister. We had to try to care for him where these other things were going on at the same time. But it wasn't all the time. We had wonderful time with him as well. There were times he got a little bit confused. Here's another really good story. I'll tell you two really good stories. Thanksgiving, the year before he died, the year that he died, actually. So we were back in America for the American Thanksgiving. Our son, Rafi, our youngest son, Ravelli's youngest brother, was there. We had a lovely Shabbos dinner. He struggled to stay awake the Shabbos dinner. He fell asleep a lot. But he sang the Zmiris. He sang along with us. He benched along with us, you know. And then he looks up, and he looks at Rafi. And he looks at Rafi, and he says, how did you survive? Huh? How did you survive? What? What? The camps. How did you survive the camps? Tafafi was born after the war. He was. Yeah. How do you know? Myself, I think. I'm the chaplain guy here. I'm supposed to know. I'm the rabbi and the chaplain. I'm supposed to know about this stuff. And I think I'm an idiot. I don't know what to say here. What do I say here? And it happened the next day as well. He asked me, you know, how did you get here? I said, Tata, I was born after the war. You were? And he didn't say this with fear, more with curiosity. And I'm thinking, like, what do I say? How do I get through? Like, I was born after the war. How do you know? How do I know? I thought, wait, I came up with something. I said, Tata, see that TV over there? Yeah? You didn't have TV in Lodz before the war. Oh. I don't know what made me say that, but that he understood. There was some confusion there. Even though he could tell us his experiences, even though he would tell us what was going through him, he could tell us what it was like to decline and what he expected on the other side. He wasn't afraid of God, but there were moments where, you know, he was really beginning to decline. When you think of it in this way, the rest of the parsha of Yaakov and Yosef becomes clear. I didn't want to include too much on the source sheets. But if you look at the rest of it, when he gives brachot to the kids, and when he talks about Shechem Achar al Achecha, you know, all the Meforshim jump through all sorts of hoops, trying to figure out what did he mean by that. He wasn't in Shechem. Is he talking about Shechem, the fight with Shechem the person, and Shechem was... And you look at the Meforshim, you can do a whole shiur just trying to figure out what he meant and how it comes together. It's a difficult passage in terms of that. But if you look at it through the eyes of someone who is cognitively aware, but close to the end of life, it makes perfect sense. What happens is that life kind of falls on each other. So Yaakov's life was all sort of coming before him as he was getting closer to death. It makes perfect sense. Forget the drushes, forget the interpretations. Shot through the eyes of a person who's dying, it makes complete sense. You can see this for yourself. Look at it that way, it'll make total sense to you. You don't have to figure out the pilpulim on it. Because life kind of all falls on itself and comes together in one shot. Closer to the end, I wasn't there, but my mother tells me about 2 weeks before he died, my dad's in bed, and he said to them, I don't know my place, he says to my mother, I don't know my place. And my mother says, as she told it to me, says Usher, his name is Asher, says Usher, in fact, their youngest son, Ben Zion Baruch Asher, is named after Samir's father and my father. Ben Zion Baruch Asher, the Asher part. His name is Usher. She says, you're in your bed, you're in your home, this is the home we built together, we raised 2 children together, we lived here 50 years. And he said, I don't know my place. I don't know my place. My mother told me the story. I said, I'm not sure that's what he meant. I said, I think he's in between 2 worlds right now, and he's not sure where he is right now. This, by the way, is a really common experience. You look through the Zohar. I don't have the sources in front of me, but the Zohar has a number of passages of great Gedolim who were in between 2 spaces, between both worlds, as they were dying. Before they died. So this is not an uncommon experience. By the way, it's cross-cultural. The Tibetan Book of the Dead, by the way, Lahavdil, has similar passages in it. This is cross-cultural. People are between 2 worlds. Okay. Let's talk about... So, any questions or comments before I go on these issues so far? Let's get to some halachic and some operational issues as well. Let's take a look at the classical halacha on here. It's 5 and 6. It's in the it's Shochanoch Yoredeya. It's in Shin Lamed Chet. It's source number 7.
Double.
It's doubled. Okay. Let's look at source number 7. That's the one I want to look at. Okay. And in fact. Did you the Ramah you
the
made both
is the bigger print?
That's right. Which is not the way it's in the Shulchan Aruch. You know, runs a smaller print, but I guess you format it this way. So the basis of this halacha essentially is that you're not allowed to do anything that is memaher shat mita. You're not allowed to do anything that quickens death. Hagoseis hari yehu kachay lechol dvar, but goseis is a dying person, someone who is getting close to death, not someone who is gravely ill, but someone much closer to death. They're considered alive. And you're not allowed to do anything that quickens the pace of death. It gives examples. We don't need to go through all the examples. We don't have time for it as well. You're not allowed to dig the grave. You are allowed to make arrangements, though. In other words, the person can buy the plot. You just can't dig the grave. Okay? So if you wonder where they want to be buried, you can do that. You can actually do that. Where I kind of draw the line, and people do it, but I don't recommend it, is to buy the stone beforehand. There are people that do it. I don't like the idea. People ask me and say, don't do it. But I know people who have, even with the name and everything but the date, and it grabbed me the wrong way. But yeah.
My uncle was very, very ill, and the doctor said, like, you can't drink anything because it's going to hasten your death. And everyone was very muckpied on that. And he was just begging everyone, please, just give me some water, please. And after he died, my aunt said, you know, I just regret so much that I let him suffer like that. I should have just given him the water. He's going to die. He was in agony. He just wanted some water.
All right, I'm glad you mentioned that. Let's look at the Rambam, because that's where this all comes from. And I'm going to apply it in several different end-of-life situations. We're going to talk about hospice care as well. This is the source in halacha for hospice care. Okay? Let's skip the first part of the Rambam. It talks about different things, the chutz and the kever. Let's go to the bottom. Three lines from the bottom. While you can't do anything that quickens death or indicates the person is dead, aval im yesh sham davar shegorim ikuv yitziat hanefesh, if there is something that is standing in the way of the exit of the soul, yesh samuch loto beit kol dofek, loto bayit kol dofek, if there is near the house like a loud knocking noise, like someone chopping wood, oshiyesh melach al shono, or the person's got salt on the tongue that's somehow keeping the soul from leaving. And these are sort of holding back the soul. Mutar lahasiro misham, it's permitted to take them away from there. This is not a maisa. It takes away something preventing it from it. Now, the source from this that the Ramah gets from the Rif, which in turn comes from Sefer Hasidim, I don't think there's any clinical data that has ever shown that the chopping of wood or the knocking on a door holds back death. So I don't know what the Sefer Hasidim based it on. I've looked into it, I've researched it, I haven't found anything at all that says where they got it from, nor do I have any proof from it. So maybe we don't take the Ramah in a literal sense, because it's talking about anything which prevents death from happening. The idea of salt on the tongue, it's been suggested by fellow Orthodox chaplains that this might refer to a saline IV. Don't know, and I'm not poskening that. I'm just noting that I've heard this. Okay? But you are allowed to allow death, the life to ebb away in its own way. I heard said in the name of David Feinstein, I didn't hear it from him myself, but I heard from two people who heard from him, two very well-known gedolim and mumchim in the field who heard this from him. Rav David said, and he's interpreting his own father's Torah, which we'll talk about in a moment, that there's a mitzvah to prolong life. There is not a mitzvah to prolong death. There comes a point where one is not mechuyev to go through extraordinary methods to keep the person alive. Now we talk about DNRs. Okay, what's a DNR? DNRs do not resuscitate. What does that mean? If the heart stops, then they crack the chest by pounding on the chest and using electrical shock treatment to start the heart again. There are risks in starting the heart again. You can break bones. It's not guaranteed. In fact, the percentages quite often, especially towards the end of life, and they have algorithms to show this, are very, very low. I don't remember, it's like 20%, you know, that it really helps. Most of the time it doesn't help. Now, if it were me, or most of you, I think you would want your heart started again if your heart stopped. So none of us would sign a DNR order because you're not allowed to. It's usher. You're supposed to, we in this room would want to be revived. But there comes a point where it might not be worth it anymore. I had a case, I asked for Moshe Tendler, this particular case where the first systems were shutting down, the kidneys were failing, there was heart failure, and she asked me, should I sign a DNR? And I asked for Tendler. He said, run, don't walk to sign the DNR in that case. So there are times when a DNR is highly appropriate. I've had shumishes of Gedalia Schwartz. If the person is shutting down, there is no mitzvah to start the heart if it's not going to really help. And keeping in mind there are risks that cracking the person's bones and putting them through suffering, pain, literal pain, because it's painful to pound the chest like that. If it's not going to help, then it's not worth it anymore. You see? Basically, I think to oversimplify, but essentially correctly identify the halacha, it's risk versus benefit. If it's going to help them live, you're mechuyev. If the risk is worse than the benefit, then you may not be mechuyev, you see. I'm not going to go into all the details of what the percentages are. I don't think that's important for us here tonight. But I'll give you some clout and some generalities on this. So that's what a DNR basically is. A DNR does not mean don't do anything else for them. Although, as Rav Schwartz has often pointed out to me, you got to make sure that they don't put this person on the shelf in other ways. So that's why a power of attorney, a child has to be an advocate for their parents. But it also means you're not always mechuyev to do everything when everything isn't going to help anymore. There is a point where things aren't going to help anymore. Okay? So that's DNRs, and that's... what about intubation? I'm going to give a simplified version of it. It's not always necessary to insert a breathing tube. especially if there's a good chance they're not going to come off of it. In fact, al pi halacha, it's a bigger problem to take it out. Because if they're going to die without it, then it may be also to take it out. There is another way to do it. I'll tell you this as a story. This happened to me in NYU Medical Center, where I served as the Jewish chaplain before we moved to Chicago. I had a case where I was called to the NICU, the neonatal internal intensive care unit. Two twins. One was doing fine, one was dying. The family was an intermarried family, but the mother was Jewish, and they wanted a rabbi there, not to paskin halacha, but to just give a blessing before they take this young baby off of the respirator. And I'm thinking to myself, this was like 13 years ago, I'm thinking to myself, what am I going to do here? Am I giving a hechsher to Ritzicha here? You know? They weren't asking me, is this mutter? Basically, they had asked the doctors, and the doctor said, this is what we need to do, and they agreed, they didn't want this to be so long. And so I went there, I wanted to call Rav Schwartz, I couldn't reach him. So I didn't ask a shiloh, and they weren't asking me a shiloh. So I went there, I said some tillim, I spoke to the baby, I actually said some words, I don't remember what I said, but we were all in tears, it was a very emotional time, and I had to step back. I was in tears, this was so emotional, standing in the face of a baby dying, they disconnected the respirator, then put the baby on the mother's arms. I stepped back because I couldn't be within Dalet Amot, but I was there with the family, then the baby died. Whatever I did must have worked because they asked me to officiate the baby's funeral. And then they promised me they're going to raise the kids Jewish. They made the surviving baby Jewish. So whatever I did must have helped. But I was still very troubled by the question. In other words, I was able to deliver pastoral care. Was I my presence there giving a hechsher to Ritzicha? I finally reached Rav. This happened on Monday. Bolivia was Tuesday. I didn't reach Rav Schwartz until Friday. But he called me back in New York from Chicago. And this is what he told me. He told me two things. He said, as far as my role there, it was absolutely appropriate for me to be there because acting as a chaplain meant that I was giving pastoral care, which is something separate from paskening halacha. So my role as a supportive rug was clearly appropriate to be there. That was helpful. It made me feel much better because the staff was concerned about my being torn by this. And what would be the halacha? This is what he told me. He said that there is a dat yachid. It's Rav Chaim Dov HaLevi, the late Sephardic Chief Rav of Tel Aviv, and Aseh Lecha Rav, his true vote, who basically paskin that as long as you're not, that if you're just turning off a switch and not actually pulling it out, that would be mutar. And then, of course, once the death occurs, in other words, you're, it's a goreim at best, and that it would be mutar in that case. That's a dat yachid. He says Rav Moshe gave a different approach. He paskin that as long as you are disconnecting the equipment for another reason, to check the equipment or to suction or to see if the baby can live for like a minute without, or the adult can live without it for a minute, then you may not be mechuyev to then turn it on again. And Rav Schwartz indicated that he agreed with this. And separately from this, I heard a shiur from Herschel Schechter where he pretty much said the same thing. So three American Gedolim were of Moshe, who's not American in origin, and Rav Gedalia Schwartz, Herschel Schechter, basically said that, you know, if you have kind of a Zevzeh Goreim situation, there's another reason that's mitzaref to allow us to turn off the equipment that would allow you to turn it off, that you're not disconnecting it for the sake of killing the person, but for some other separate reason.
Question is, how often does that happen, that there's actually another reason to turn off the equipment these days? Modern equipment, you don't usually need to turn off, I don't think, anymore, in order to fix it or refill it or whatever.
Equipment, it all depends. Sometimes they do it to test the equipment. Sometimes they do it to suction the patient. Sometimes the equipment goes off and on by itself, which makes it a little bit easier, actually.
The newer equipment still goes
off by itself, so that's what you do in a case like that. This is lahalacha. This was lahalacha that he gave me. So that's, and now every case is a little bit different, and the technology might be a little bit different, but that's a general guide. I actually wrote stuff as protocols for the hospital in a case where it would come up with a patient who, you know, cares about halacha. That's what they should do in a case like that, be respectful of that. So that's another piece of this. What about nutrition and hydration? What about the case of that? It's interesting that comfort care, in other words, the standard of comfort care nowadays, based on fairly extensive studies, is after a certain point not to give the patient food and liquid. Now, what does the halacha say about in general? I'll get to your case in just a moment. But in generally speaking, I think most poskim will not agree with what the medical world says today. The medical world kind of has defined nutrition, hydration at the end of life as medical care, which you give or not give at will. Just like you wouldn't necessarily give other types of medical care. If they're dying, you don't give them medical care either. The conservative and reform movements have basically come around to this. They have it in writing. I can show it to you. I have yet to talk to a posek, and I do talk to a few of them, that would agree with saying that food and nutrition and hydration is medical care. Okay? Rav Moshe doesn't look at it that way. I'll tell you what Rav Moshe says in just a moment, because he has a long series of tshuvas in Tzadik Beit in Yoredei, I think it is, which deal with it. Okay? But Rav Schwartz said, we can't tell the person. However, I actually happened to, in the middle of some research, which I haven't finished yet, I've been doing this for several years, trying to put together the studies and take a different route that actually brings us to the same conclusion using this Ramah as the basis for it. And that comes to this question of whether food and nutrition actually, and hydration actually quickens death. That's actually the research I'm doing. From what I gather, first of all, there are risks in feeding tubes. The mortality rate in putting in feeding tubes is very, very high. It's like 30%. Second of all, there's a lot of suffering. What role does suffering have? Here's Rav Moshe's tshuva, okay?
Do you mean when you put the tube in, kill them?
No, but you could bring on death quicker. Okay, okay. And they're on several levels. One is that there's a risk of infection. Feeding tubes have a risk of infection. Now, if the person is going to recover or have something meaningful, or they're going to live a long time, they're not dying, then there's probably a chiyuv to put in the feeding tube. You can't commit suicide. Actually, Rav Schechter once told us that Rav Schechter actually gave a lot more leeway to it than Rav Tendler on this. Even though they're on opposite sides, that Rav Tendler follows brain death and Rav Schechter does not, on this they're actually on the opposite sides. I remember Schechter's words. I was at this shiur. It was an amazing shiur, and I think we have it recorded somewhere, where he says that the patient actually has a lot of leeway to decide medical care as long as it's one of the accepted routes of medical care. And he said it several times, this was to a group of Orthodox chaplains, he said, you're not allowed to discontinue life support for a hangnail. And he said that several times.
For what?
A hangnail.
A hangnail. What's a hangnail?
It's an affected nail.
Like a hangnail.
An affected toenail. All right? He said that several times. Okay?
It's in his farm.
Clearly, Rav Schechter is getting a lot of leeway before you get to the brain death question. Rav Tendler is a bit more machmir. He says there are sometimes you have to be mechuyev and other times not, and it depends. Okay? This is what I learned from the people with whom I've consulted over the years, and I'm happy to, you know, say b'shem omram, as I heard it. So what about nutrition hydration? This is my chiddush, and it's not at an advanced enough stage that I can actually publish it and get haskamas. Rav Schwartz urged me to continue the research. Part of my problem is I'm so busy with patient care, another thing, I don't always have time to do it. But I have my notes. There are a lot of studies out there that suggest that after a certain point, stuffing in feeding tubes and putting in IV tubes can actually be harmful. The best practices out there actually give a different approach that would meet the halacha, as I understand it. And you will find these mostly in the nursing journals. It's interesting, I'll get back to that in just a second. It's interesting that there was a whole dispute in the medical community. If you look at classical medical literature, was also against taking away nutrition hydration. The palliative care field was more in favor of it. As time has gone on, more mainstream medicine has come around to the palliative approach of not pushing nutrition hydration after a certain point. So there's an influence in the medical field, and you can actually track this by the studies they're done by when they were done. I've done this, okay?
But when you're talking about hydration, you're talking about through an IVR or something. If
that's correct. You got it.
Give normal drinking, that's fine.
Okay, so here's the point. Part of the problem, why is there even a havamina to do this? So in cases, a lot of it's dementia, but not exclusively, the swallowing reflex becomes weak. They can't swallow anymore. They can't eat anymore. So the only way to get food into them is through the feeding tube. That's the havamina. That's why why not? So give them food. But there is an in-between approach. There are several in-between approaches here. And one, and this is in the nursing journals, is to give them comfort food that is easily swallowable. Liquid foods that are swallowable. Liquids, ice cream, and sure, things that they like, soups, applesauce. And not just for the nutritional content, but also there's a pleasure in eating orally, which you don't get from feeding tubes. That also meets the halacha. because halacha said we can't starve him. Well, we're not starving him. Okay. In addition, and here's get back to the case of somebody where if they're thirsty, the question is why are they thirsty? In hospice care, they have new technologies which involve subcutaneous injections, which is not the same as an IV. An IV goes right in the bloodstream. Subcutaneous is just a tiny needle in the skin with fluids, and that keeps the body hydrated enough without too much pain and suffering, and it doesn't overpower the body either. So there may be ways to give the patient the liquids they need without them feeling they're thirsty. Palliative care really does this very well. And that's, if I were in that situation, I don't know if your family did in that case, I don't know. But what I would do is ask the palliative care, what do I do here to keep the patient comfortable? Comfort is desired by halacha. In Rav Moshe's tshuva, Rav Moshe has the question of, must you put a feeding tube if they can't eat anymore? And our emotion says we don't force it. That it might be desirable. If it's going to cause suffering, we don't force it. So our emotion got it, that there comes a point where you're not going to help them either in quality of life and probably not in quantity of life either. So what they can eat, the patient kind of guides with my father. He guided us. He ate as long as he could, and we could no longer eat. He stopped eating, and he did not want to be forced, and we respected his wishes. And he died when his body was shutting down. What happens towards the end of life is that the body starts shutting down. And this brings us now to the clinical reasons behind the case that we heard.
What does the
system
mean?
I'm sorry?
I've heard a lot. What does it mean the body is shutting down?
It means the systems, the kidneys, cannot process liquid. The digestive system cannot process solids anymore. So, if the kidneys are shutting down, to force liquids by orally or by an IV would be mamaher shat mita. They absolutely would. You are causing death quicker. And that's why the preferred response is not to force them liquids. And this is my chiddush here, that there comes a point where, based on the Ramah, it's desirable not to force nutrition on them. So we're still holding the principle that this is not medical care, it's food nutrition, but we end up at the same conclusion that after a certain point, this is not comfortable anymore. That forcing a person is not comfortable and will cause them suffering and will kill them quicker too. That's what happens towards the end of life. And the hospice professionals can tell you at the various stages, there are ways of staging these things. When the kidneys aren't doing output anymore, when the stomach's not processing anymore. And usually, if the patient is aware, they can actually tell you about it. Patients whose minds are still functioning actually know these things. There's a wonderful Or HaChaim, actually, tucked away in Vayelech Moshe, right? The end of Moshe's life, Vayelech Moshe, right? You all know the pasuk. Classical question, where did Moshe go? He went, where did he go? So they'll force him about all sorts of interesting answers, and they're all, you know, good answers, great for drushes, great for ethical concepts. The Or HaChaim follows the approach that he went to say goodbye. There's a whole school that says he went to say goodbye. But tucked away, it says that 40 days, I believe, Ibar Ilyon, Moshe knew he was going to die, and that's why he took the time to say goodbye. Now, and that a person knows 40 days before they're going to die, they're going to die, says the Archai. Now, whether 40 days means 40 days, again, the Shi'ur is not important for us. But many people do know that they're going to die before they die. My father certainly did. He was able to tell us what he was experiencing at all these various stages. I mean, with severe dementia, of course not. But in cases where it's just some confusion, they can still articulate what they're feeling and they know they're dying. So they can talk about what they're experiencing. And in fact, palliative care and hospice care, the professional literature suggests that the patients are our best guide for what to give them. When they want to eat, you give them what to eat. When they don't, you don't. You follow their lead. And that's in general true of Bikur Cholin in general. That's in general true of many, many other things. And it's good clinical advice. Okay? We're going to do one more piece. We're almost done. I've really gone over time, but I want some time for questions too. Let's just look at sources number 5 and 6. They're the same. Note lamut omer lo hitvada. Somebody who's going to die, tell them, say vidui. Okay? And it's vidui. Vidui. Now, vidui, we don't have time to go into details of this. There's a classical vidui. And part of the vidui, actually, it's really helpful because at some point where they're not close to death, but they want to prepare themselves, they're not dead yet, and they may have plenty of life left. The Omer alone, they say, Harbe hitvadu velo meitu. Many people confessed and didn't die. So you're not dying. Just because you're putting yourself right with Hashem doesn't mean you're dying. And many people didn't confess and they did die. So with the reward that you make me do it, hopefully you will live. Okay? There are many ways we cover Olam Haba. That's one of them. Okay? If you can't say the words, you can think them. I do this a lot with my hospice patients. We develop actually an end-of-life prayers booklet, because we often get, and I didn't bring it with me, but if you want to see it, if you want to see what it looks like, go onto our website, the Jewish, JHNC, Jewish Union of Chicago, at jcfs.org, and we have them posted. They're really nicely graphics. I translated the classical vidui into English for not just Orthodox people, but all sorts of people, and I also added some of the psukim from the Mavar Yabok, the classical psukim that are said with a goseis, the tefillat ha-goseis. It's really upset me. The old madrich, the old golden madrich, had it in there. The RCA madrich dropped it out. It was a big mistake. Because, you know, lech shilach ha-shem, lech v'ashem ya'imok. Go because God sent you. Go and God will be with you. Hashem yishmorcho mikoroi, shmort nafshecha. These are just wonderful psukim that give such comfort to a dying person and to the living family that's there. And so I did a version of it in English, and we include it, and we use those. It's become very well used in Chicago with across the board.
Can you repeat the website again?
It's JHNC. Go to Jewish Child. If you Google Jewish Child and Family Services of Chicago, you'll find it. Okay? And look for
I'll find it for you.
You'll find it. And it's Jewish Healing Network. So we have stuff that I put on there, stuff that other people put on there. So, but the booklets are there. They're really lovely booklets, and we send them all over the country. All the hospital chaplains use them. All the hospice chaplains use them. So it's a mitzvah to say vidui, and knowing how to present vidui is a little bit of wisdom, and knowing where the patient is. If they're cognitively aware, then you follow Shulchan Aruch. But if they're close to death, you might say it with them or for them. And the way I introduce it is that we all make mistakes. For non-for people especially, it's hard to. Well, why should I say vidui? I'm a good person. I didn't do anything wrong. I'm not here telling you did a lot of things. Who am I to say that? But the way I express it is that we all make mistakes in our life, every one of us, and before we meet our Maker, we want to make things right. So if you can hear me, please think the words with me, and I read the words in English with them or in Hebrew, and we do vidui. That's how it. So this is how we help people not just get to Olam Haba, but negotiate with not just the halacha, but the pastoral and ethical wisdom which is intrinsic in the halacha that Yiddishkeit and Torah have for us at not just the beginning and the duration of life, but at the end of life as well.
If somebody's just something's happening on the way to a hospital, but you don't know if it's like life-threatening, we don't know how bad it is. Do you say vidui in the ambulance when you don't know how bad it is?
Well, you could. There's a wonderful Gemara. I have a different set of sources. I couldn't recall all of them while we're praying this here. But there's a Gemara, and maybe somebody can remind me where it is. I just don't remember where it is, but I have it on my sources. Tzarchatam litvadot yom achad lifnei moto. I think I'm paraphrasing. That everybody should die a day before, should say vidui a day before they die.
Does anyone know?
Oh, so the Gemara goes on. That's the question. So how do you know? And the answer is, if you live like you might die tomorrow, then you'll be able to, then you win, basically. I mean, I'm paraphrasing the Gemara here, it's my own interpretation, but it's essentially correct. So basically, a person should be doing it frequently, all the time. Not all the time, it's morbid. But that you shouldn't wait till the last minute to say vidui and put your affairs in order. So if you're in the ambulance, and it's grave, and you can think to yourself, that might be time to say vidui. Now, vidui can be a one-liner vidui, okay? May my death be a kapara before Hashem. Of course, the longer vidui says, it's conditional that if I die, may my death be, and if I live, etc. That we say. I think did I include it in here? I didn't include it in here. Is there
the one line? The Amandel is Fatos Omer. Third line, source number six.
Amar mitati te kapara l'chol avonotai. The longer vidui reads, Galui v'dua shemitati urufuati biyadecha, that you know that my death and my cure are in your hands. May it be your will to heal me with a fuash lema, but if I die, may it be a kapara for me. That's the longer version of vidui. And of course, you can do ashamdi, you can do many other things with that as well, but that's the basic vidui.
Is there any concern that vidui might hasten death?
That's a really good question. And part of what we do as chaplains is kind of assess that. In other words, if we know they're dying, they're dying. If we're not sure they're dying, we kind of have to feel them out, and you got to use really careful listening skills. Because if there's any chance that it would hasten death, you don't do it. That's a really good question, and you need to assess that before you even suggest it.
I think it's most in the last line, verses 5 and 6, and that's the indicating that point.
Yes. Yes. Actually, that's a good way to read it, in fact. V'chol elu hadvarim ein omrim lo bifnei akam ha'aretz. Now, what that means, I think we have to interpret it clearly, because, you know, people are knowledgeable. If somebody who is an intelligent person but not knowledgeable, usually not Amaretz, I'm not sure. We have to see. V'lo bifnei nashim, not before women. That's, you know, you might think of it as a sexist comment. Lo bifnei ketanim, shema yibku v'yishavru libo. But the last few words actually tell it to us, as Revolian pointed out to us. In other words, if it's emotionally jarring for any reason, putting aside the examples of it, then it's not appropriate. So that's a good point. Thank you both. Okay. Yes, Bakasha.
This summer, I don't deal with end-of-life issues. When people have cancer, they're gone, oncologists. However, you got somebody who's a 38-year-old woman diagnosed with breast cancer, said, I'd rather die than lose my breast. People are depressed. You have antidepressants for a month, whatever, they can make other decisions. They have throat cancer. I can't eat. I want to die. Do they really want to die, or are they depressed? How do you deal with the depressed? Not really end-of-life issues. It could become end-of-life because they're depressed. Is it like suicide or not suicide? How do you tell them apart?
Oh, really good question. That's where you need chaplains and social workers and people who are trained to help people struggling with depression and downers. In other words, what's behind that? In other words, I think part of the approach that a chaplain that I would use is, you know, noting that losing a breast, losing a limb, I had that case a couple weeks, somebody was going to lose a leg and they would rather die than lose the leg. Same case, okay? In other words, to note the idea that there is loss there and to let them know that their loss has been shared and heard. That often helps a lot. To know they're not just grieving, there's grief going on there. They're not grieving alone. So talking to a compassionate professional can be really helpful in terms of helping get through that and to give them hope. You know, there is hope that to them, when I'm losing a leg or losing an organ or losing a breast or losing, you know, an arm, that there's no hope anymore. I can't do what I did before. I'm not who I was before. I'm not the same person. So helping them find some meaning that actually there's a large part of it left, and what can you hope for? What might be there for you in the future? What can you look forward to? Part of what we deal with is hope in chaplaincy. We try to help them find. Not that we impose it. We don't try to convince them. That's not how we do it. It's helping them find it within themselves. So that's a really good point. That's what we try to do. Thank you for asking that. Yeah?
Oftentimes, I guess, there'll be, say, a parent who may not be from, and you have children who are from, or vice versa. You may have a from parent in the care of children who are not from, and the values can sometimes be on a collision. Can be a very big source of, you know, family strains and stresses and clashing of values. Do you have any advice of how to navigate these
event directives?
Yep.
Well,
sometimes
it kind of works, you know. I mean, if the parent wants something and the kids want something different, it can be difficult, let's say.
That's a really good question. Cases where parents are not from, the kids are from, or vice versa, or the kids are divided among themselves,
exactly.
You see. Let me deal with it first legally, in the States at least. Again, I can't speak for Israel or other places. I promise I'll talk about Canada. If I have time, I'll get to that. Canada. Briefly, in Canada, by the way, since it's socialized medicine, the government makes the decision as to who gets medical care and who doesn't. Not the halacha and not the family, all right? So if they decide medical care is not worth giving anymore, then they will say, you're not allowed to give this aggressive treatment. And there are cases that I heard about at the airport from this fellow that he litigated in front of the Canadian Supreme Court where there were religious issues and they appealed to the government for that. So getting back to the question of when the family is divided here. The first issue legally, who gets to call the shots? In other words, halacha is halacha, but in terms of the hospital's eyes, they just need to know number one of the patient's wishes, and that they're bound legally to follow. Aye, the halacha says different, doesn't matter. The hospital tries to be respectful of halacha, but in the end, the patient calls their own shots. Next to that, the person who the patient designated as the power of attorney. So, what if the patient wants something? In other words, I want to be cremated, or I want to be, you know, not treated at all. And you feel that halacha does not allow this, you may not want to be the power of attorney in that case, because then you'd be giving a hefsher to that. So you have to think about whether you can, you know, support the parent's wishes before you sign on to that. Okay? What happens when the kids are fighting with each other and the parent can't express their wishes? We have these kinds of cases a lot in the hospital. And the hospital just don't, what do we do here? I get called in to mediate these kinds of things a lot. Part of what I do, and part of what the social workers also do, is look inside the family system dynamics as to what's going on, why are they fighting. More often than not, the cases that I get is that the halacha is not really the main issue. A lot of times, families will use halacha as a mask for other kinds of issues. In other words, there are cases where if they would really ask the shaila, which they didn't, they just assume this is the halacha, psak would be, you may not be mechoyev to do what you're suggesting you do. It's a mask for their own inability to accept the decline of a loved one or the loss of a loved one. I've had this many, many times. Okay? So that's another thing to look for, is that what's underneath it, that it may not always be halacha, maybe some other dynamics going on here. But in those cases, if you can get your family member, the patient, to sign on to halacha, that would be the best thing. But you don't want to do it in a way that's going to upset them or agitate them. That's also usher. Partly because it's not kibud of an aim, and partly because it might quicken death also if they get agitated. So if you can do it gently, that would be a great thing. If not, you may have a disagreement on that, and you have to follow their wishes. In the case of where their siblings fighting with each other, it's a tough situation. There's no easy answer for it. The hospital listens to whoever is, you know, at the top of the list in terms of the powers of attorney. And if there's no power of attorney, then they're going to follow hospital ethics. They may call an ethical consult, where the rabbi will have a voice, but not psak necessarily. So in other times, I've been asked for Jewish wisdom and Torah wisdom, and I'll tell them, you know, what the wisdom is. But I'm one voice among several voices in the ethical consult. And what we try to do is keep as many people happy as we can within the parameters of good medical care as the hospital understands it. So there's not one answer fits all in a question like that. It's a really good question. It's one that's happening more and more often, see, frequently enough. That's why it's important to have the conversation in advance.
This may sound like a silly question, but is there a health physician on death by Skype? Like, someone's in bed dying and, you know, letting everybody, sharing that moment with everybody out there in other countries. Is that like a possible thing to do? Is that a possible thing to do?
It's not a silly question at all, actually. It's a very interesting question, and I have yet to see or read about a tshuva on that particular subject. But interpreting what I know, and it is anias dati and kalas dati, I'm not that much of a Talmud Chacham. But from what I do know, if it's done in a way that keeps the kavod of the patient intact, and for the right reason, we're trying to be there with them, support the family, support the patient, and not as a spectator event, then I would think not only is a mutter, it might be a very good thing to do. But if it becomes a spectacle, then, you know, it's not a spectator sport dying. Then I would say it's a bad thing to do. I think it would depend on the mode. That would be my thinking just off the top of my head. And it's not a silly question at all. It's actually a very good question. It's one that's going to come up as technology increases. We have the ability, heck, we're present for other things, you know. I like to hear, you know, I couldn't be at the britot of all my kids, many of them, his brit I was in Israel for, but other ones I was not in Israel for, but I got to hear it by phone. So we have the ability to do these things nowadays. So if a family member is dying and people want to show support, I would say, yeah, that could be a good thing. Thank you.
Can we talk about organ donation?
Yes.
And I mean, differences between Ashkenaz, Sephardi, when it's Mechayev, when it's Mutar, when it's
Asher. I have to admit, I don't know Sephardi Psak. I really don't know it at all. So I can't speak to that at all. And I know what the Mechaber says when Maran says it in some place. Maran says it, I quote that. But I'm not good at Sephardi operational Pesach. I don't live in that world. I'm not, I can't speak to that. I'm speaking from the Ashkenazi, rabbinical experiences that I have had over the years. This would be a two-hour shiur by itself. The short version of it is as follows. Number one, it's a mitzvah to save lives, period. It just is. Number two, it's a mitzvah to save major organs. The major tshuva on cornea transplants written by Rav Unterman was based on an earlier tshuva that came from Chicago from Rav Regensburg, who was your grandfather's, my father-in-law's Rebbe, okay, Mishmer Eschaim. All right? So there is plenty of good, solid psak as far as organ donation and save lives and save organs. So mostly people agree it's a mitzvah, it could help. The real problem nowadays is not so much the question of the recipient, it's the question of the donor. So if it's an organ on which life is not talui, then there's no issue. Am I allowed to donate a living kidney for me to somebody who needs a kidney? Maybe. Is it a chiyuv? Maybe not. I'm giving you an oversimplified version, but that's where the tshuvot kind of are around, whether it's a good thing or a chiyuv, or not a chiyuv, but a good thing, and you're not putting yourself in danger. But I think the core question that you're asking here, where all the controversy is on donating a life-maintaining organ like a heart. Okay? Now, here's the problem.
So just talking about before that, you're saying that there's no problem to donating an eye of the dead.
I won't say it's no problem. I would say it's generally accepted to save an eye. Whereas for research, that's highly problematic. But to actually save somebody's eye, that would be mutar. Yes. Okay, that's not as disagreed upon as some other things.
And mitzvah?
Yeah, I would think so. According to Rav Nerman and Rav Regis, yes, it's a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah. Yes.
What if it would make the tahara impossible?
I've done taharas, and I don't think it would make it impossible. I think good chevers have ways of getting around that. Okay? Basically, you cover, if it's a limited organ, you cover the organ, you wash the body. That's how we've done it when I've done taharas over the years. I think would make it still possible. The question then comes up, though, what about a heart? Other organs like the heart, but the heart's the biggest one, okay? Because you can't live without the heart. So the person has to be dead before you donate a heart. But the question is how you define death. And the classical explanation of Gemara and Yuma, of course, is that the heart has to stop, or the breathing has to stop, or the heart and breathing have to stop. And that's a whole, that could be 2 hours of shear in and of itself, and I think you've actually given that shear, haven't you?
I don't think here.
You haven't hit? So how do you deal with that? Well, it's not easy to. So if you follow one or the other classical versions of that, you can't donate a heart. But if you follow one or the other, there are several versions of the brain death issue. I'm going to oversimplify it, and there are several versions of it, okay? But the bottom line is that the version that Rav Tendler, based on Rav Moshe's tshuva, and from everything I've seen, Rav Moshe said what he said, okay? And Rav Tendler got it right, and Rav Schwartz has told me that he believes Rav Tendler is the correct interpretation of his father-in-law's tshuvas. Other people say not, Rav Schechter says not, but I've actually read through the tshuva, and I've read Rav Moshe, and I've heard this from other people, that Rav Tendler actually has the medical piece more correct, which is why I tend to be following him on these kinds of things, is that brain death. Now, the Rabbanut's version of it, which is Rav Yisraeli's tshuva, this is the other version of it, and this is where medical science mostly today, not from the Mishnah Halot about the Lata'ah and then the Lazarus reflex, but more that the brain is the organ that controls the heart and the lungs. I'm terribly oversimplifying it, but I don't think I have it wrong here in terms of what I'm presenting. Is that, and I have this from neurologists as well, as that the brain is the only organ that cannot function independently. A heart can function independently. You put on a heart machine. The lungs can function independently. You put them on a respirator. And the person might be dead, but the breathing went up and down. You see the chest up and down. You can't do that to a brain. You can't make the brain work by itself. So basically, when the brain stops functioning, then thereby the lungs and the heart will also stop functioning. I'm terribly oversimplifying it, but I think essentially that's the bottom line of that definition of death, that when the brain is no longer functioning, and there are all sorts of tests to make sure that it happens, then that person is dead. So, getting back to transplants, so if the brain is fully dead and the heart is still alive, you can then have a living heart to transplant, and that would be mutter. But if not, it would be usur, because it's ritzicha. It all depends on which route you follow here.
Don't usually have a few hours after a person...
Not with the heart. You have a limited, a very limited period of time. If the heart stops beating, it's no good anymore. Yeah. Certain other organs, yeah. Certain other organs, yeah.
You can't, like, breathe in. I believe in Israel for a total cessation of blood flow to the brain.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really
yeah.
Total blood flow.
And that's based on neurological criteria. You know, the neurologist can actually speak to that because that's their field. Yeah. So, like I say, it's oversimplified. There, like my file on this subject is like yay thick. I collect all this stuff over the years, so there's a lot more that we could say for going on for hours and hours. And I don't claim to, you know, be the greatest halachah minute, but I know a few things about it. That's what I'm sharing with you here. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.